from Midori House in London, and a very warm welcome to Sunday Brunch. We're live here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up, roll up, roll up. The circus reaches 250 years old. But what future lies ahead? Plus,
what if we go around collecting songs of love and we don't talk to people about politics? Of course, the project is inherently political, but I guess we wanted to find a way of having a different kind of conversation.
We talk about a different sort of ever closer union as we meet a woman who's travelled across Europe to record and gather love songs. And
the trace of the first hunting lodge is still at the absolute centre of the palace. The famous marble court, the Cour de Marbre, is actually just the sort of exact replica on the same place as that first hunting lodge was. So literally it did grow outwards, upwards and every way.
We discuss the Palace of Versailles, and the reporter Vincent McAvinney will be in the studio to go through the weekend papers, and the couple behind one of London's best-loved little restaurants will join me in the studio to teach us how to prepare Middle Eastern food at home. That's all to come this hour live from London with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. We begin this show with a birthday. It is 250 years this year since the circus, as we know it, was born. It's taken many forms since then, both good and bad, but at its heart has been the pure joy of escapism. Well, let's meet someone who really did run away to join the circus. To discuss this, I'm joined by Vicky Amadumi. She runs Upswing, one of Britain's foremost circus companies promoting diversity. Vicky, a very warm welcome to Monocle 24.
Good morning.
So you ran away to the circus, really?
I did, and my parents are very proud. No, I was at university when I discovered circus, and I just fell in love with it. So instead of kind of leaving university and going for a proper career,
what were you supposed to be doing?
I was meant to go into research, scientific research.
Right,
but the circus called me, and I ran away to France. I got to France. I called my parents and told them, this is what I want to do with my life, and there we go.
But that sort of ticks all the boxes that one imagines that you're the stereotypical circus performer, literally doesn't tell anyone and then rocks up and says, hello, I'm in the big top. Is that a sort of prerequisite for anybody who joins a circus?
No, you don't have to run away anymore. There are degree programs. You can go and get a degree in circus now. So there's the National Centre of Circus Arts in London and Circa Media in Bristol, where you can study properly for 3 years and become a Bachelor of Circus Arts.
That sounds so, I don't know, a bit too normal for my liking. You need to have a little bit of a danger to it, because at the heart, I mean, let's talk a little bit about the idea of the circus and the fact that it's 250 years old. If we had walked into a circus performance, you know, a quarter of a millennium ago, what would we have seen?
It would be completely different. So the first circus with the ring that we all recognise as the circus now was set up by Patty and Philip Astley 250 years ago in London. And you would have seen an array of different acts. You would have seen horses. I hear it was quite rowdy. But it was very fashionable entertainment at that time and something that hadn't been seen before.
And at what point did the essential elements that one now associates with the circus, or the idea of the circus, come to fruition? I'm thinking of clowns, acrobatics, yeah. And it must be talked about the inevitable inclusion of animals.
Yeah, well, all of those things existed in isolation before Patty and Philip set up their amphitheatre. They just brought it all together in one kind of really exciting big night out. So they really started the idea of popular entertainment.
Popular entertainment, which then grew into the circus that a lot of people came to understand about, the idea of the clowns and the animals. Let's just briefly discuss the issue of animals. And it went through an incredibly dark time about 20 years ago when suddenly everybody sat up and realised that you shouldn't do to animals what people had absolutely taken for granted as what should be done.
It's a really interesting topic. I think circus animals and circus have always been associated, and I've known a few animal trainers in my time, and I've seen the way that they work with their animals. And I think the the cruelty that's often perceived as what happens in a circus, I haven't ever seen that. That saying, I personally don't believe that animals should be performing. I think what people really go to the circus to see is human beings being extraordinary. But I've certainly never seen any of those cruel practices that people talk about myself.
So let's talk about these extraordinary human beings, of which you are one. You're a former trapeze artist, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, I am.
If you haven't seen this lady's upper arms, I can vouch for it. They are magnificent. And that is because you have spent a large amount of your time suspended from the ceiling on a rope.
Yes.
You do need to be pretty extraordinary to do that. What was it like the first time you had a swing?
The first time I went up in the air, I my heart was literally in my mouth because I hadn't ever done anything like that before. So I came to circus fairly late in my life. I was probably about 20 when I first climbed a rope.
The average age of a circus newcomer is what?
Well, now that there are circus programs, particularly in Europe, there's circus programs where people can get involved from about 6, 7, 8 years old. And if they haven't been involved in circus training directly, they'll normally have come from a gymnastics background or something. I hadn't done any of that. I'd done a little bit of dance. I'd done quite a lot of athletics. So this was completely new for me. And it was just the coming together of that kind of sense of adrenaline, that potential to be artistically expressive. I fell in love with it.
And you meet this team of like-minded souls as well.
Yeah, that's the one thing that I really love. One of the many things I love about circus, there truly is a community around it. I think because we all literally at times put our lives in each other's hands, you do form really strong bonds.
So then you now run Upswing. Tell us a little bit about what kind of circus that operates, because it has a tremendous amount of theatre in it, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I think circus kind of exists in everybody's imagination. So when you ask anybody what is circus, they have an idea of what it is, and it tends to be quite traditional. And it tends to be the circus in the ring with the big top and the clowns, et cetera, and that kind of circus still exists and is very popular and really important. But when I started my company, I was really interested in making the kind of circus that was relevant to me and the world that I'd grown up in. So I wanted to bring in other cultural influences. I wanted to explore combining circus with things like hip-hop. And as the company's grown, we've got more interested in the way that circus can communicate to people, the way that it can tell stories. And I think it's really unique. It's an art form that, if you can connect it with an idea or a story, it speaks to everybody. You don't need words. You don't need to have read a particular set of books. You know, it is truly democratic.
You've talked in the past of how we have a fragmented society, and if you have something extraordinary, it brings us together. What does that mean?
Well, it goes back to that thing. I think people like to see other human beings being extraordinary. And circus gives us the opportunity to really see that, to see people being just amazing human beings. And, you know, as a company, we do a lot of participation and outreach as well. We bring different people in who might not have experienced circus before and get them to feel extraordinary about themselves.
What do you do?
Well, quite recently, we did this amazing project in a care home. I see your face. Yes, in a care home where we worked with the staff and the residents. We were mentored by this organisation called Magic Me, who do a lot of arts activities in care homes. And we got people doing juggling, manipulation, some acrobatics and aerial work as well.
And you need to explain that a little bit more vividly.
So we got some people doing some aerial work, working in cocoons and just exploring what it is like to just be
how
off the floor.
How old were these people?
60 to 90.
Okay. And what was their reaction to it? It would be extraordinary, given the fact that once you are in an institution, your parameters change. But to be then placed in the air.
Well, you know, of course, when you're in an institution, people want to take away risk from your life because nobody wants to be irresponsible with that with the responsibility of care. But risk is part of life. So what we were trying to introduce was a controlled, a safe, playful way to engage with doing something that you didn't expect that you'd be able to do. And the staff did it as well as the residents. And what was amazing was you couldn't always tell who was going to be really good at the skills. So quite often you have this 90-year-old, we had this 90-year-old man who was incredible in the aerial cocoon. And some of the staff members who, you know, normally look after him and consider him to be quite fragile couldn't do the things that he could do.
That's amazing. That's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
So you're going into care homes and outreaching, but you're also including or encouraging a very diverse group of people to join Upswing. What is it about the people who work at Upswing that marks them out perhaps as slightly different from what has been done in the past with circuses?
Well, I think circus has traditionally functioned outside of the mainstream. So that's not that unusual. But what I did notice when I started performing was I was one of very, very few black performers, one of very few non-white performers. And I, you know, have grown up in London, which is one of the most incredibly diverse cities. And I just thought, I'm working in London. Why are there not more non-white practitioners in the field? So I really wanted to see that change. And I also really wanted to see the tone of the work that was being made change and bring in other influences. So that's what Upswing is really about.
So a couple of questions that come from that. What was the change that you saw? What kind of people were coming in and what skills were they bringing in?
So I'm really interested in cross art form practice. Circus forms the base of what we do, but I'm really interested in how other art forms can feed it and just make it richer, make the experience richer for an audience. So quite often we're looking for performers who can not just do the physical skills, but they can also engage an audience. They can act, they can sing, they can move in interesting ways. An example is our show Bedtime Stories, which is a show for families. And within that piece, you know, it's a very, very simple story that we're trying to tell, but it demands that the performers in the piece are able to act and speak, as well as do the circus skills. And we worked with a designer to create an environment that felt like it was a fantastic space for an audience to come into to watch that piece as well.
You talk about the fact that you're based in London, the people that you drew from London, you know, created a new kind of circus. But where does your circus now travel to? Are you just in London, or are we going to see you absolutely everywhere, all over the country and the world?
No, we're starting to travel all over the world, which is really exciting, and all over the country. So in December, we will be in Dartington, which is in Devon, at Dartington Hall, as part of a programme of arts activities. And we're taking our show Bedtime Stories there. And that's going to be really exciting.
That's amazing. And given the idea that the British have that very traditional view of what the circus is, and you're busy changing that. But let's say you travel around the world. I mean, the French have a very, very active sort of physical performance world.
Yes.
And then all you need to do is just look at Cirque du Soleil, which comes from Canada.
Yes.
Yet has Olympic performers dazzling the world. And are there a certain countries which you just think could do with catching up a little bit?
I think, you know, we have a little bit of a challenge in the UK in the fact that other countries invest a lot more in the arts. You know, we do have a brilliant arts council that does support innovation in the arts. But, you know, you look at the amount of investment that an organisation like Soleil has had in Canada. They started from a very, very small kind of two-man band, and now they are like a world-leading corporation, and that's because the investment in the arts has allowed it to become, you know, it's allowed it to grow and become massively successful,
which is what we hope for Upswing. Vicky Emma-Dumi, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. And Upswing's Bedtime Stories runs at Dartington in Devon here in the United Kingdom from the 6th of December to the 6th of January, the perfect Christmas treat. Still to come on Monocle 24, we celebrate Middle Eastern food and we head round Europe to hear something to do with love. Stay with us.
Stay one step ahead of the breaking news.
People are saying, look, enough is enough. The middle class is getting squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. The rich are getting richer. And they're saying, look, this is not a fair game.
Hear industry-leading insights from our experts.
When tech companies have problems, they can go south very quickly. BlackBerry, Nokia, nowhere near the companies they used to be, but both were invincible. Nokia boasted that they were one of the first companies on the planet to sell 1 billion of their products.
And catch up with Monocle's Bureau around the world. Every weekday at noon London time, keep your appointment with The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Studio One. You're listening to Sunday Brunch with me, Emma Nelson. Now, this week has been one of turmoil in the United Kingdom. Theresa May, the Prime Minister, tried to push through her Brexit deal, surrounded by resignation threats and letters of no confidence. It feels like there's not a lot of love for the UK or indeed for Europe, depending on which way you're looking at the moment. But that's not completely true. Oh Europa is a project by Artists Action Hero. They set off from Bristol in the United Kingdom 6 months ago to travel across Europe to record love songs by people they met along the way. And Gemma Panton, who's one of those behind the project, spoke to Georgina Godwin about her travels.
We drove for 6 months through almost every country in Europe, and we decided that we would invite people to sing us a love song. Any kind of love song, a modern song or a traditional song or folk song. They could sing alone or sing with friends. And then what we did with those songs is that we're broadcasting them. We're broadcasting them right now from the edges of Europe, from borders and edge spaces, things where there's a kind of point of convergence or a point of separation. And the love songs are broadcasting 24/7 forever in those places.
An absolutely fascinating project. Now, you were doing this in a van in which you were living at the time as well. How did you get access to the people that came, that you basically invited into your home?
It was a mix, really. Sometimes it was just people that we met on the road, sometimes friends of people who would introduce us and say, oh, I think you should definitely go meet this person, and then we would sort of make a date to go meet somebody. And then in general, we worked in partnership with about 10 different organisations in the UK and Europe. So on the whole, we would sort of arrange to be at a certain place at a certain time, a music festival or an arts festival or a cultural centre. And then we would sort of set up our van in public space. We convert the back into a little recording studio, kind of DIY recording studio, if you like. And then we would just sort of be there for the day and have signs in the local language saying, we're recording love songs. Do you know a love song? Would you like to contribute to our love songs project? And we would just sort of be there and wait for people to come.
Let's talk about some specifics. So tell me about France. We're going to hear a little bit of the French music. So give us the story behind this one.
Yes, so we were recording love songs in Lille, in the north of France. We were in a couple of different locations around the city. And so this particular song, we were in one of the kind of local neighbourhoods, not in the city centre. We'd been there for a couple of days, sort of. And, it, you know, often when we arrive somewhere, it's nice to be there for a few days because it takes people a little while to kind of get used to what you're doing, or some people are very brave and they'll immediately come and sing a song and think, oh yeah, I know a song, and they kind of understand the idea of the project and they want to add their voice. And then other people, it takes them a little bit longer, and they think, they come back the first day and they see it, and then they go away, think about it, and then they come back the next day and then they decide to sing a song for us. So that's what this song was.
Si tu crois petite, si tu crois que ton teint de rose, ta taille de guêpe, tes mignons biceps, tes ongles d'émail, ta cuisse de nymphe et ton pied léger.
And now on to Portugal.
This was somebody who was introduced to us actually by a friend of a friend of a friend who said, oh, if you're coming through Portugal, you have to meet this guy. He's called Luís. He's a storyteller. And she said, you have to meet him because he knows so much about the community where he's from. He lives in Faro in the Algarve. We went to go meet him. He invited us to his house for dinner. And he said, OK, I'm going to sing you some songs. I'm going to sing you this song. And it doesn't even have a title. He just said, oh, I'll call it traditional Algarve mountain song.
Não chove nem faz orvalho, menina, que hás de ser minha. Ai, não me des tanto trabalho, meu senhor rapariga esta. Toda noite me namorava.
It must have been amazing. I mean, you must have got to meet so many people and really be catapulted into the heart of their lives.
It's true, actually. Yeah, I mean, I found it very moving because you make this invitation to people to say, come in to my home on wheels, and I'll listen to you. And whatever you want to sing, I'll record it. And that invitation, I think, for lots of people, it's... I think people want to be heard. Mm. And so when you make that kind of invitation, it's kind of incredible what people come with.
You were also in Scandinavia. You visited Sweden and Finland. Give us an idea about those countries.
Yes. So, I mean, one of the things that was so interesting about the project is the kind of the different kind of cultures around singing, but also different national characteristics, I guess, if you can say that, around attitudes to singing in public, or whether people are confident or reserved, or they want to sing straight away, or it takes them a little bit of time. And so in Sweden and Finland, people did kind of conform to that national stereotype of being, they're more reserved, they're just a more reserved people, I think, like the British are, actually. And so we got less songs there, but the songs that we did get were, I guess, all the more meaningful for that, because you knew that this kind of, there's this barrier to coming and singing for a stranger who you've never met. It's just not in the character of the people to be, you know, kind of vivacious and outgoing. Mm. Yeah, so we recorded some incredible songs there.
So tell us about the Swedish song.
Yes, so this song, it's called Kristallen, and it's a song which men sing to women. So the person who sung it for us said that often male choirs will sing it. And it's a song of, she described it as, it's a song of loving respect to the woman.
Min vän, och älskogsblomma. Ack, om vi kunde tillsammans komma.
What about Finland?
She read about the project in advance, this woman, and she decided she was going to come. Which is kind of interesting, actually. We often have a mix of people who just come across it, and then people who've read about it in the newspaper or they've seen about it on the radio and they think, oh, I want to come, and they prepare a song in advance. She was one of those people. She said the song that she sang, it's a folk song, and it's about, she described it as saying, my love is my love, but she looks very funny, like she has the face of a horse. You would see her in the market and you wouldn't choose her, but I love her anyway. So it's funny because when you hear the... I think the melody of the song tells you that story, even though I don't speak any Finnish, so I couldn't kind of understand the meaning of the words, but I think you get the sense of that just through the melody.
Minun kultani kaunis on, vaikka on kaitaluinen. Minun kultani kaunis on, vaikka on kaitaluinen. Hei luulia illalla.
You were also in Romania and in Hungary.
Yes, we were. And again, just such a different culture around singing. I mean, in Hungary, for example, they have a really, really rich folk tradition. And so, you know, compared to, say, when we were in France or Germany, people sing a lot more pop songs. In Hungary, it was almost exclusively folk songs that people sing. You know, all ages, people just know those songs. And there's also a particular way that people sing. We recorded a lot of older people in Hungary and Romania. And, for example, these kind of tiny old women in their 90s would come to sing in these small groups. There's a lot of people singing small choirs in their villages. Tiny, tiny women, very, very old, and they come and sit down. And then when they sing, the voice is so strong. It's incredible. Like, just the sound, the sort of strength of the sound is really amazing. But yeah, this particular song is sung by three younger women, actually. The women who sang it described it as, the title means, I tied my lover to a post like a horse. So there was, I think there was something like lost in the translation of the meaning of it, but the literal translation is, I tied my lover to a post like a horse.
Hogyha vonat vágná össze az én árva szívemet, a kereke vésné fel a nevemet, az ujjamra sírítem a gyűrűt.
And the Romanian song.
Yeah, so the Romanian song, I don't know what this song is about. So these two, they told me that they sang in a band together. And he normally plays guitar, but they didn't have an instrument with them, so they decided to kind of like rehearse a little a cappella version. They came in, sang the song, which is incredible, and then they just had to go because they were in a rush to go somewhere. So it's one of those ones which it's a mystery to me of what the song is about.
Yes, Dinkasa Samaduk, Nor my dorule.
Now, Gemma, you started this project before Brexit, but of course, since then, Europe is basically falling apart. And I wonder what your journey and what this collected music tells us about Brexit and how the continent's changing.
We had the idea for the project before Brexit, before it was even on the cards. And then as it sort of became less a hypothetical thing, and then it was like, it's a reality. And then it was like, okay, it's happening. And then it was like, okay, it's happening next year. It suddenly felt like we have to do this now for practical reasons, but also because it felt like, from a British perspective, Brexit is kind of at the centre of our experience around what the conversation around Europe is like at the moment. But in the wider sense, I guess there's this kind of narrative, I suppose, that Europe is in crisis. I don't know if it's true or not. I think in some ways, of course, it is. But then I think for James and I, there was this sense of that we needed to do something that could respond to that, I suppose. And then we had this idea of, well, what if it's love songs? And what if we go around collecting songs of love and we don't talk to people about politics? Of course, the project is inherently political, but I guess we wanted to find a way of having a different kind of conversation about Europe, because I think it's very difficult to have a conversation about Europe at the moment. It's also very difficult for us to listen to each other. Us in the general sense of society, we find it really hard to listen. And so there's something about collecting these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of love songs where you give space to people to say, I'll collect your voice and I will broadcast your voice across the entire continent on an equal footing with the voices of all the other people who are living in Europe now, to give an opportunity to listen, and what we might find when you create space for listening. So I think if you go to one of these beacons and you listen to these love songs, and all these beacons are in border spaces of some kind, it's an act of deep listening, which I think is something that's needed, because unless we can find a way to listen to each other, then we're never going to be able to find a way to live together. And we have to live together because we share a continent.
Oh, Europa, the project by artists Action Hero. Gemma Panton was talking to Georgina Godwin. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Time for our weekend read. And this week's guest is Colin Jones, a professor of history at Queen Mary University of London and an expert on 18th century France, a busy time in history. Colin's latest book looks at the creation, extension and adaptation of the Palace of Versailles.
It started as nothing, really. Until the early 17th century, there's essentially nothing there. It's a very sort of hilly and particularly woody area. There's a little clearing, there's a windmill on the top of it. And then Louis XIII starts going in that area to hunt and establishes a small hunting lodge, which basically then grows and grows and grows.
I mean, exponentially.
Yes, it does. And funnily enough, that the trace of the first hunting lodge is still at the absolute centre of the palace. The famous marble court, the Cour de Marbre, is actually just the sort of exact replica on the same place as that first hunting lodge was. So literally it did grow outwards, upwards and every way.
Now, the history of Versailles is inextricably linked to the life and the legacy of Louis XIV. Why was it so important to him?
Very good question. I think it was a place where he could really establish himself in his own eyes, but in the eyes of his contemporaries, his subjects in France, but also his peers in Europe, as the greatest ruler in Western Christendom, essentially. And he also had a big eye for posterity as well. He wanted to sort of establish himself as a figure like Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar that everyone talked about, that was a sort of endless point of reference when people thought about power, glory, magnificence.
You talk about it being almost mythologized.
Well, he does mythologize it, really. He mythologizes it to glorify his own myth. He's endlessly present in the palace itself and its gardens. His image is endlessly there, but also representations of him. The sun, for example, is one of the metaphors, one of the images which is always there. He established himself as the Sun King, if you like. But lots of other little signs, the L's, which are everywhere. Just everything refers back to Louis XIV. This very self-referential palace, which mythologizes the king and obviously then mythologizes the palace as well.
You talk about the shift from myth to history and link that, in fact, to the fabulous ceilings.
Yes, it is actually, that's right. In fact, the mythologization proceeds in different ways. Initially, it's with the comparison with the sun. He is Apollo. He dresses himself up and dances in his own ballets as Apollo, for example. This is absolutely the center of everything. And then he goes through a number of other registers, and particularly in the ceilings, and you see this most strikingly in the Hall of Mirrors, he mythologizes his own victories. He's there represented in a manner which people probably think that's the way you paint Jupiter or whatever, but there's Jupiter on a horse, maybe wearing a sort of cuirass of the sort that they would have worn in earlier times, but with a wig, you know, which is very incongruous, really, mythologizing the great moments of his reign. It's actually, people say, even his advisors say, you know, this isn't really very diplomatic. All the rest of Europe will come to the palace and basically see France crushing them in a series of defeats. And in fact, it does become very notorious for its self-glorification.
Because as you write, it's not simply greatness that was on show at Versailles. It was French greatness.
Absolutely. He is bringing the country together. I mean, I think he's one of those rulers who some people find very difficult to take because he is so full of himself in many ways, but he does play a big part in the joining together what is essentially now France. So yes, he does have that very national role as well.
You talk in the book about the lifestyle and the culture that developed in Versailles. I mean, the court people developed a particular way of talking, of walking. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I found that fascinating when doing it, that basically you've got a little community. It's not that little, actually. It's thousands, really. Less than 10,000, but certainly attached to the court, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people at the height of the thing. And they live there, essentially, or live in Versailles and establish a sort of microculture, really, with its own ways of doing things. Always court ceremonial, court hierarchies at the center of that. But there are little things like one of the ladies-in-waiting there says, there's a particular way of walking if you're a woman because you mustn't pick your feet up because the danger is that you'll step on the train of the ladies in the procession in advance of you. So there's a sort of shuffling style, if you like, that women adapt, which is, I think, just shows the sort of microculture that's there.
Yeah.
I was also very interested, actually, on that point by thinking so historians have focused so much on the elite, on the king, on the courtiers. But, you know, that's the top of the apex of a very wide pyramid of service, building, just maintaining, you know, providing for all the wants and needs of daily life for this extraordinary group of people. I tried to give it in the book a sense of that this is people doing this sort of underling stuff as well, which is absolutely vital for the running of the palace.
Because, of course, we see it as a monument now, but back then it was this living, breathing city almost.
Absolutely. And interestingly, the city grew really with it. There was, again, there was just it was really a couple of hundred when Louis XIII established the hunting lodge. By 1789, it's fourth, fifth, sixth largest city in France. It only achieves that level again in the 1930s, because as soon as the king has gone and as soon as the palace is looking for a new vocation in some ways, the town falls away and you just don't have that service sector, that infrastructure of service, which has been such an important part of the palace's functioning.
Now, one of the chapters in the book is called Republicanizing, in search of a new role. So I wonder how the French dealt with what was the biggest symbol of the monarchy after the revolution.
Yes, I think that is one of the things which I really enjoyed doing in the book. I mean, I knew I would enjoy the 17th and 18th century history, but I wasn't totally sure what I'd say in the 19th and 20th century. And what struck me was really in 1789, there's a massive question mark over what to do with this palace. I mean, it's built very much to the measure of Louis XIV. It becomes the home and the sort of place of glory of his successors. But when you're moving to a constitutional monarchy and then a republic and later an empire, what do you do with a building like that? Initially, there are some people who say, well, it's like the Bastille. It's a symbol of oppression and absolutism, and we should knock it down like they did, obviously, with the Bastille. It's too big a thing to do that. But then, really, I think for the 19th century, successors, and of course there's a number of successors because the political history of the 19th century France is very turbulent, are looking for a vocation for it. The man who really comes closest to finding a role for Versailles in the modern world is King Louis Philippe, who's the king between 1830 and 1848. He doesn't live there. It's not lived in after 1789. But he conceptualizes it as a museum of the history of France, and he builds new big galleries which have enormous paintings in them, which give every great French battle, really, from Roman times to Napoleon. That, if you like, is a role, but it soon becomes a bit faded. People don't turn up in the same way. The place is falling apart. And then right at the end of the 19th century, a very remarkable curator, principal curator at Versailles, a man called Pierre de Nolac, comes in and realizes basically the future is looking back to its past, not imagining a future, if you like, but really building on the fact that in the 17th, 18th century, it was a massively impressive cultural monument. Not only does he have that concept of the palace in this period, but he also has, if you like, the business model, which really they're still working on. There's still the basic elements of that put together by Pierre de Nolac. And that is, first of all, government money is important. Of course, government obviously sees this as important, but it will never be enough. That's what he realizes. And so basically the other thing to do is to develop philanthropy. That's actually quite unusual for France, because France always has this very strong state centralization sort of model. But he realizes that there's potential there, and he cultivates big donors, particularly, again, sort of quite in quite a pioneering way, Americans. And there's a famous moment in the 1920s where John D. Rockefeller gives $1 million to restore it. It's a great publicity coup. If you look now, still an enormous amount of American philanthropy goes in. Americans, after the French, are by far the most numerous visitors to Versailles. Mm. And the other thing he picks up on is the visitor experience. You know, you've got to go there and enjoy it. The visitor's actually got to want to go there. So actually things like people wandering around by themselves rather than following boring tour guides, putting in restaurants, putting in public conveniences, all those very basic things we think basic now in any sort of museum. But at the time, it's quite pioneering.
Colin Jones there, speaking to Georgina Godwin. And Colin's book, Versailles, is out now. To hear more from Georgina, check out Meet the Writers. You can hear the full back catalogue online at monocle.com. Up next on Monocle 24, on Sunday Brunch, we go through the weekend papers.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
Time now to look at the weekend papers. Joining me in the studio is Vincent McAvin, a UK correspondent from Euronews NBC, and a man who spent most of his time on College Green outside Parliament this week trying to tell the world about what's happening with Brexit. Bit of a job you had this week, Vincent.
Quite the job. It was all pretty fast-paced. It felt like a Game of Thrones series finale. It was pretty intense.
Well, very, very glad that you've taken your time out from, hopefully, I thought you'd be lying down in a darkened room with a damp flannel over your face, but no, you've come in to go through more news for us, which is heroic, frankly, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
So take us through the weekend papers. What have we got?
Well, I think we'll start with The Observer, which has got some really good coverage of what has happened this week. Some really good explainers of who has gone, who has come in, and what could possibly happen next. So, you know, Theresa May, the strategy from number 10 seems very much to be she keeps going. So on you know, she did 3 hours in the Commons on Thursday, and then we were summoned to a press conference in the afternoon. Then she did a phone in on LBC on Friday morning, and then this morning she's out doing interviews as well with broadcasters. So there's a bit of coverage here about how her strategy is very much to keep going and look like she's keeping working, and it's earned her praise in the FT as well. They've got a column where they've gone to kind of middle England, and all the people they spoke to says even if they're not agreeing with her, they think that she's working hard and people are quitting unnecessarily. But the Observer sort of sets out now where we go from this. So Theresa May carries on, but there is this possibility that she may face a leadership election tomorrow because there's more letters of no confidence going in. But even if it does get triggered tomorrow with these 48 letters, there still doesn't seem to be a rival candidate who could beat her, because that person would need to get 153 Conservative MPs behind them. So in the papers, there's lots of speculation about whether it will be Boris Johnson or Dominic Raab. They have emerged as the front two runners to try to take her on. I personally don't think that Boris Johnson would command anywhere near that level of support. If you look at the kind of hardcore Brexiteers that might rally behind him, that's about sort of 50 people. But Boris Johnson hasn't made friends with the 2017 and the 2015 Conservative Party intake. He's been shown up a lot recently. His time as Foreign Secretary was not well reviewed. And so the papers saying that Theresa May likely to win any kind of leadership challenge, but then where does she go from there? Because bringing this bill, this plan that she's been able to get through this week to the House of Commons next month, there is no maths which would get it through the House of Commons.
What do you think of the general coverage of the newspapers this morning? The reason why I asked that is because I've been knocked sideways by the front cover of the Sunday Times. It has a picture of Theresa May and then a close-up of Dominic Raab, the Brexit secretary who walked the day after the Brexit deal was done, apparently refused to get on a plane to Brussels to help to get it signed off on the Wednesday evening. Apparently the plane was sort of ready to push back and he wasn't doing it. The headline on the front page of the Sunday Times is "Stand Up to Brussels Bullies." Now, that's created quite a strong reaction from lots of parties this morning, given the fact that one often thinks that the Sunday Times is in-depth, well-thought, well-thought-of, intelligent, reasoned, measured. Yes, it has its own agenda, but to distill everything down to "stand up to Brussels bullies," to me, sort of indicates the kind of language and the argument that is still being used when we're talking about our deal with the EU.
And to be clarified, that is a quote from the interview with Raab. It's not their headline. It's not an opinion piece from the Sunday Times saying it. But
Have two tiny little quotation marks.
Yeah, quotation marks around the side of it. I mean, there is a theory being floated in the papers today, and I think this is mentioned in the Sunday Times, that actually Dominic Raab was a suicide bomber for David Davies, and I hate to use that term, but that's the term being used, that Dominic Raab used to be David Davies, who was his predecessor as Brexit Secretary. Dominic Raab was his chief of staff. They are very close friends. When he replaced him, the idea is that he never really engaged properly with the job, and that is partially because Theresa May had full control of the Brexit negotiations at that point with her advisor, Ollie Robbins. And so Dominic Raab was just waiting for this moment, going through the motions, and then destroyed it. And then, you know, on Wednesday, when I was outside Downing Street, the reports that were coming out after the cabinet meeting was that Dominic Raab was actually very quiet, that he didn't say much during the meeting. And, you know, if you're someone who's just spent 4 months supposedly in Brussels negotiating hard to get this, well, you think it'd be very strange to sit in a meeting with all your colleagues and not to fight for what you've got. Now, the argument is that much of it was probably done around 90% before he actually got into the job. But you think accepting that job and the weight and privilege and responsibility of government, you would then accept that you had to convince your colleagues that this was the right thing to do. So it does kind of weigh into the idea that perhaps he wasn't really in it, his heart wasn't properly in it. And I think, yeah, there is still this, you know, ridiculous language being bandied about somewhat about, you know, fighting for Britain and, you know, they need us more than we need them. That's being bandied about by the Brexiteers in the paper. And in the same way as in the US with Trump, there is at times a detachment from reality.
And that detachment from reality you have been conveying to French and international viewers on Euronews this week. And what is generally the feeling from the international media and your French colleagues when you start telling us or telling them about the chaos down at Downing Street?
Yeah, it's interesting. The Observer, actually, page 9, they've got puzzled Europeans watch and say it doesn't make sense. And, I mean, the meetings that I have, you know, on teleconference with colleagues from around Europe to talk about what's going on is that they're like, but what do these people want? What do they expect? You're the ones going. And that is something, and I think, you know, it is, it's very tricky using just the British newspapers to kind of get a proper reading on where Europe is. It's something they've neglected. I think the Irish newspapers, particularly Irish Times and Tony Connolly at RTE, who actually broke the story on Tuesday that a deal had come through, have given a much more, obviously they're not the ones in it, so there's, it's less impassioned, but Ireland will be heavily affected by whatever happens. And the Irish newspapers have done a really standout job of it. But yeah, there's pictures here from Le Monde, El Pais, La Repubblica, all just sort of utter confusion about what is going on and about what it is that the British want.
And if anybody wants to giggle, they should look up what the sign language expert did when trying to explain Brexit a few days ago. Her hands were only the beginning of it. I would urge everybody to look it up, because what her hands were saying were, her hands were demonstrating conflict and aggression. Her face was just expressing pure bafflement, I'm sure, and confusion. Yeah. It was brilliant. It's this indication that Brexit cannot be put into words, and this one woman's face tells it all. What else have we found? Is there anything in the papers apart from Brexit, Vincent? Please do say yes.
I mean, it is incredibly Brexit heavy. and I was going to talk about something else Brexit related, but
no,
we can skip it if you want. But
if it's worth it, I'm sure if you've chosen it, it's worth talking about. What is
This is emails reveal Aaron Banks' links to Steve Bannon in quest for Brexit cash. So Aaron Banks is a businessman. He called himself the bad boy of Brexit. He is under criminal investigation. He was under investigation from the Electoral Commission, but that has now been passed to the National Crime Agency. They're investigating him for an amount of about £8 million, which they don't think actually came from him going into his Leave.eu campaign. Now, that wasn't the official Brexit campaign, the Leave campaign, but it did play a heavy role and has continued to be active with some quite dodgy tactics on social media. They've been accused of racism and xenophobia quite heavily, and Aaron Banks has been very bullish on all of this. But these are emails that have come to light prior to the referendum in 2016. They're from October 2015, in which he talks to Steve Bannon in the US, obviously influential. We all know him from the Donald Trump campaign and the Breitbart website, about raising funds from the US for the campaign for the referendum. Now, that is illegal. It is illegal to take funds for political campaigns in the UK from elsewhere, from overseas. So that is more trouble coming to light for Aaron Banks. This is something that will probably be put into the investigation. And apparently Steve Bannon, when he's been asked during interviews by Bob Mueller in America, who's doing the big inquiry into the 2016 election there, he's been asked about links to Aaron Banks. So that's more trouble for Aaron Banks, and it'll just create more of a whiff around the 2016 referendum, which I think is something that is starting to take hold with the building of the motion behind a kind of so-called people's vote. This second referendum is that if more evidence comes to light that something wrong was going on in 2016, if there was money coming in possibly from Russia, then that might help the Prime Minister to turn the ultimate U-turn and back a second referendum when she can't get her deal through Parliament.
Before we move on to other subjects, just briefly on the idea of whiffs and public campaigns and the such. What's astonished lots and lots of people, actually, is when you look at the likes of Donald Trump and the fact that he is steeped in allegations of what was done, what wasn't done in the run-up to the election. And there has been scandal after scandal after scandal thrown against him. But in actual fact, the only thing it has seemed to have done is to actually centre support by people who backed him. Those who backed him will back him even more.
There is that core base that will never shift, and that's what he's trying to get, that 40% that took him into office. But I think if you look at the results, and there is analysis of the results in the papers today, looking at the Sunday Times has got a good bit about, the initial reporting at first was quite wrong, that it wasn't sort of the blue wave had failed. Well, actually, in these recounts that have happened, thinking about the Arizona Senate seat that they thought had gone to the Republicans, but actually it was the first bisexual woman to ever win in the Senate, and she was the first woman since 1960 something to first woman for Arizona and the first Democrat since 1960 something, that actually a lot of the initial reporting was wrong, and that Democrats did have a huge night in those midterm elections. And we saw that play out with Donald Trump last week, and the kind of, you know, his PR disaster trip to France for the centenary of the armistice, where he basically didn't attend events and sat in his room having executive time, which is code for watching TV and tweeting, and then attacking Emmanuel Macron.
There is also the issue, let's go to a story that you found in the midterms about voting and issues in Florida. It's in the New York Times, is that right?
That's right. This is a New York Times piece called At Issue in Florida Tally, Voters' Penmanship. And I think it's still quite remarkable. I don't know when the last time you went to the States was that, Chip and Pin is only new in America in the last couple of years, and it was a big deal for them. They were still, you know, swiping and signing up until a couple of years ago. And now it's only last year that places like Walmart have stopped taking signature payments after the largest card networks, American Express, Discover, MasterCard, and Visa, stopped the requirement to sign via verification. And I think that's something that, you know, a lot of young people now, they're constantly typing, and so they don't have much penmanship, you know. And so this is an interesting article about a study that young people don't actually have signatures anymore. It's different every time. They're not doing it on a regular basis. They chip and pin. And this is about thousands of ballots in Florida that have been rejected because people's signature didn't match. And one of the examples is a woman who gave on an electronic signature pad, which I don't think ever looks like your actual signature because it's so clumpy and pixely. Apparently her ballot was rejected because it didn't match her electronic signature pad when she got her driver's license a couple of years ago at the DMV. And so she and others are starting to protest the fact that it shouldn't be based on the signature, and especially not compared to an electronic one, which never looks the same.
Will this alter the way that America approaches its elections, though? I mean, Florida is always that glorious place where something utterly unexpected goes wrong, that to completely throw the way that the electoral process goes through. They've got a good, they're getting form now, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, that was a joke put out in the last couple of weeks that, you know, I can't remember who it was, but they said, oh, they're still counting ballots for Al Gore back there. You know, we all remember 2000, it was the hanging chodes was the ballot where that was how Bush won, was that you punched holes and some of the punched parts were clinging onto the paper, and so they had to be discredited. So I think Florida will probably look after this election at trying to fix all these problems, but it is interesting that something as silly as a signature can really stand in the way of people's democratic rights to vote.
It's interesting, I'm just reading an article at the moment in the New Review, that in the East End of London, the Victoria and Albert Museum, that wonderful British institution which shows effectively is the museum where of design of objects of beautiful artifacts is being opened up in the East End of England, and the director is saying that the changing role of museums in modern culture, in the era of fake news, we need museums to help us. There's actually very little to help us sort of make sense of fake news and, you know, stories when you hear of the validity of people's signatures anymore. It's all very interesting to think that we don't trust anything anymore, do we?
No, I mean, that is true, and all organisations are trying to combat it. And this is something that actually, another story which is good today on the in the FT and on the front of the New York Times is about Facebook and how much trouble the company is in about the shares hitting a 20-month low. And a lot of that is to do with people losing trust in the platform, and that they have pursued this agenda of rapid expansion. You know, Mark Zuckerberg is very fixated on the idea of getting the whole world onto his platform. And it's about how Sheryl Sandberg, you know, she got angry with their head of security for revealing to the board information about the what they discovered the Russians were doing, how they haven't handled that well, but also about how really they just have lost the public's trust on this. You should have a skeptical eye, and it's something that now has to be taught in schools, is to have a sceptical eye on this kind of stuff.
Vincent McAvinney, thank you very much indeed for taking your time out to go through the papers. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Once upon a time, there was a tiny restaurant near to the Euston Road in London, so cramped you had to tuck your elbows in as you tucked into delicious Middle Eastern food. It wasn't a very big reach to nick your neighbour's lunch either. It was for some time a delicious secret, but as is the way of all good secrets, no one could keep quiet about it. Little by little, Honey & Co's reputation has grown from tiny gem to stalwarts of the weekend supplements. Well, Honey & Co chefs Sarit Packer and Itamar Srilovic, join me in the studio now, because you have written a book, haven't you, Sarit, about the kind of food that you find in Honey & Co, the fact that you can make it at home now.
Yeah, I mean, we started writing a book, first of all, about our new deli, Honey & Spice, and we kind of changed our mind halfway through, and we thought, actually, we have so much more to say about the food we eat at home and how easy it is to eat most of this food at home, and the book evolved slowly into something quite different.
Yeah, it was the accidental cookbook.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it came out so much more personal and so much more, well, homey than we originally set out to do.
Yeah, and we do all this work for the Financial Times, and we write kind of a weekly article in the food. And we, from getting feedback, because it's very immediate, writing in a newspaper, so much more than publishing a book and it comes out a year later and stuff, we started getting quite a bit of feedback and people taking pictures, and we started to see the recipes that people actually cook are the easier ones, the ones that, you know, are happier and the ingredients that you can find in a supermarket. And it just made no sense to try and make a book that wasn't that. So it was very much about that, about trying to make it accessible.
That very much resonates with me. As hands up, I declare an interest. I have the Honey & Co books at home. Yeah. And I confess to you before we came on air that I've never cooked anything from them. Your books have until now been this delicious fantasy in many ways. You take us to your restaurant and you tell us the stories of love and triumph and failure and late nights and blood, sweat and tears and the joy that you get of feeding it. And when you read it, you do actually think, I could never recreate that joy, but you have decided that actually you want to make it possible that I can open the book and feel empowered that I can make something delicious.
Well, I think that the Honey & Co book, they had to fulfill a very specific promise. You know, you had to get the food as it is in the restaurant. And I think everybody that cooks knows that, you know, there are the cookbooks that don't work. It will work.
No,
you know,
it will.
If you follow the recipe, it will work.
Yeah. They're the recipes we use in the restaurant. They're not anything else, but it is a restaurant book.
It's a restaurant recipe, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, home food shouldn't be that. It should be a lot more forgiving, a lot easy, a lot more, you know, accessible. It's not about cooking to a standard. It's about getting it, you know, nice, getting it decent.
Take us back to when you first started Honey & Co. I mean, the restaurant, I'd probably say, is not much bigger than the studio that we're sitting in. When I first walked in, I remember I was a wretched soul one wet Saturday afternoon. I think I'd just become a mother, so I was possibly not the most balanced of creatures. And I walked in, and I remember you, Itamar, said to me, I will never let anyone leave this restaurant unfed. Arguably not anything that either your kitchen or waiters want to hear. But there was that engagement with love, the fact that there was this offer of comfort and food and care that immediately characterised everything about the restaurant to so many of your fans.
Well, I think it because we didn't know any better. You know, it's true. When we opened Honey & Co, we both were in kitchens, you know, in basement kitchens for what? 15 years,
and you never see the customer. Actually,
we had no idea how a restaurant works. So the only way we knew how to do is like how you do at home. If someone comes to your home, you're not going to let them leave hungry, or you're not going to say, "Go away, I'm not going to feed you." So it was not a choice. It was just the only thing that we did that we didn't know how to do.
And how have you managed to translate that feeling of welcome and desire to feed and to please into what is now an enormous empire? I mean, you say that you don't spend much of your time in the original restaurant anymore, Sarah.
I've had to spend a lot of the last 2 years in Honey & Smoke. It's a really big project, and it took more of my time than I thought. So what we did is a bit of a split custody between the two of us. Itamar kind of took hold of the kitchens in Honey & Co and the floor in Honey & Co. And he does a lot of the front of house in Honey & Smoke. But the kitchen needed some real attention here. It's a 9-seater restaurant. It just took a bit more
90.
Time for...
90, not 9, sorry.
No, yeah, you're right.
You'll fill up
9 would be easy. 90-seater restaurant on two floors. So it just took that much longer for us to train everyone to be able to handle it and stuff like that. So
how do you upscale when you go from tiny restaurant to what you've just described with well, that, with while, a, while keeping the essence of what made you work in the first place?
With a lot of headaches.
And I mean, and actually it was so crucial to us to, you know, the reason that we opened Honey and Smoke is exactly that, that we what we were doing in Honey & Co, because it's so small, is all we were doing was sending people away, and it drives you crazy. Yeah. You know,
it's the most disappointing thing.
It's such a sad thing.
We didn't turn you away, but sadly, over the years in Honey & Co, we have turned away so many people. And
we couldn't have it.
And it's so against our character, because this thing that Itamar said to you is the way we are. Like, if someone is hungry, of course we want to feed them. And it was just so frustrating. So now at least we can say, I can't feed you here, but 5 minutes down the road, there's a bigger place, there's more likely to be space. Go there.
Off and you go. Finally, we don't have much time, but with your new book, At Home, if you told me to go to a certain page and cook something that you knew by this time, you know, for dinner tonight, my family would be happily fed, what would it be?
The chicken and plums, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why? Chicken and plums in Tarragon.
Because you do get, this is kind of the tail end of plum season, yeah. But they're really, really beautiful this year. Because okay. of the summer, and it'll take you 2 minutes to whip up together. The result is knockout.
That sounds like just the kind of cooking I like. Sarit Packer and Itamar Srulovic, thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio. That's all we have time for this edition of Sunday Brunch. Thanks to our producer and studio manager, George McDonough, and our researcher, Mariana Legrasta. Coming up, Bill Ryder-Jones is on the Midori House Sessions playing some great live music. And then from midday, Tom Edwards and Augustin Macellari are here with the Monocle Weekly. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great weekend.